genuineness of the supplication.
Bright, give me the strength to do as you will have me do.
The prayer stopped, for God's chosen had felt the tread of the high priest through the crust. As Bright's first came nearer, God's chosen appeared at the entrance.
Let us go and receive the blessing of Bright, he said,
leading the way to the holy temple. Together, the high priest and God's chosen moved through the throngs gathered in front of the western orifice. They were followed by a large group of astrologers, all experienced in speaking to crowds. Slowly, the procession made its way through the packed inner courtyard and up the slopes of the inner eye mound. At the top, God's chosen and the high priest took up a position at the center of the mound, while the other astrologers formed a circle around them. God's chosen looked out at the multitude, whose every eye seemed to be upon him. He would have liked to have talked to them all directly, but there was no way that even his far-carrying, high-pitched voice could reach them all. Fortunately, most of the throng had been to one of the previous services, where he had called down the blessing of Bright, so they knew the ritual. God's chosen scanned the eyes. It had been many turns since he had last seen the beam from the inner eye, and he was now unsure exactly when to expect the blessing to come. God's chosen began the service as they had planned it. He would chant the prayers, which would carry out and down the mound to the nearest ranks of Chela. The chant would then be repeated by the high priest and the rest of the astrologers, the combined treading of the chorus carrying through the crust even to those at the farthest walls. The prayers would then be echoed by the rumbling treads of the multitude.
Bright the glorious, we believe. Bring your blessing.
God's chosen paused, but nothing happened. He went on.
Bring your blessing down upon us.
He paused again, waiting in vain for the blessing to come down upon them all. In desperation, he continued,
we are waiting in your temple. Bring your blessing.
For the first time in many greats of turns, God's chosen felt his faith falter. There was a subdued murmur from the crowd. There was nothing hostile, just bewilderment, for God's chosen had never failed before. God's chosen gazed upward at the eyes, longing for the sight of the blessing. None came. Without further word, God's chosen moved his pale body through the ring of astrologers, down the mound, and out into the multitude, heading for the eastern orifice. Some of the crowd whispered as he passed. Others reached out to touch his hot, pale body with a slender tendril. The high priest, still up on the mound, tried to salvage things by proceeding with a regular worship chant. But no one paid him heed, not even the chorus. As God's chosen left the temple, the multitude of worshippers broke up into bewildered groups. Many had gone without food for a full turn, and they now went out to find something to eat in the overcrowded city. By the next turn, food had run short, and the crowds became nasty. Some recalled the original clan name of God's chosen. And from then on, whenever he was mentioned, it was by his old name of Pink Eyes. The high priest went to discuss the previous turn's events with Hungry Swift, the leader of the combined clans. Hungry Swift was completely demoralized by the experience. I am sorry that you too were taken in by that charlatan, Bright's first said.
But I saw the blessing coming down,
protested Hungry Swift. Yes, you may have seen the Blessing of Bright, but this pink-eyes person was using the Blessing of Bright to his own advantage, the High Priest replied. He said that he gave the word of Bright, and that he was God's chosen. But was he? No. Bright chose this way to say that he was a false prophet, for Bright withheld his blessing before all the multitude.
You seem to be right, Hungry Swift agreed.
I am right, the High Priest said. I have served Bright longer than this pink-eyed hatchling. You must do something about this fraudulent impostor.
Hungry Swift was too dejected to do anything. Bright's First took advantage of his hesitancy and gave a command to a squad of troopers nearby.
Bring Pink Eyes to the temple, he commanded.
The troopers hesitated, looking at Hungry Swift, who remained silent. Finally, the troopers moved off to carry out the High Priest's command. They found Pink Eyes in the wilderness to the east of Bright's Heaven. He had been going back toward the eyes, constantly looking upward for the missing beams of light. The troopers had no problem with Pink Eyes, and they treated him gently. Most of them had experienced the blessing of Bright and were still in awe of the personality in the tiny pale body.
You are to come with us, the squad leader stated.
Without a word, Pink Eyes reversed his direction of travel and went back along the pathway, with the troopers surrounding him. As they slowly made their way back west, paced by the small tread of Pink Eyes, the crowds gathered again. As they passed, most of them stared, their tread silent. Other groups, hungry and angry, muttered into the crust, and a few rolled sharp fragments of crust into the pathway in front of Pink Eyes. He did not swerve, but moved steadily onward, often leaving a sharp fragment wet with his warm, white juices after his tread had passed over it. The squad leader saw what was happening and put two troopers on either side to keep the pathway clear. As they passed through the outskirts of Bright's Heaven and headed for the temple, the crowds following them grew. As they entered the eastern orifice of the temple, Pink Eyes saw that the inner courtyard was partially full. The troopers led Pink Eyes up the inner mound where the High Priest and the leader of the combined clans waited. Bright's First led the interrogation.
"Are you God's chosen?" the High Priest asked.
"If you believe it, then I am," was the reply.
"Well, I don't believe it," the High Priest said angrily. "Admit you are a fraud!"
Pink Eyes made no reply. Bright's First turned his eyes to Hungry Swift and said firmly,
"I say we should turn him into meat."
Hungry Swift hesitated.
"He did bring us the blessing," he said.
"Maybe,"
countered the High Priest.
"But where is it now? He has caused us to lose it."
As the two leaders talked, Pink Eyes had been gazing alternately at Bright and the eyes for guidance. Suddenly, he saw a beam from the inner eye.
"I can see it again," he called out.
"What?"
the startled Hungry Swift asked. The High Priest was worried. Could it be that this creature had arranged all this in order to bring down Bright's curse upon him, to destroy him and take over as High Priest?
"I can see the blessing of Bright,"
Pink Eyes said. But then, in despair, he saw that the beam was no longer coming toward them, but instead was pointing toward the north. Hungry Swift looked up at the inner eye, searching in vain for the faint flicker that he had longed to see these many turns.
"I don't see anything," he said.
"I am afraid that you cannot," Pink Eyes said. The beam is now going off to the north.
The north? The High Priest exclaimed in relief. That is the territory of the barbarians. By your own admission, you have caused Bright to avert his blessing from us and give it to the barbarians.
There were angry murmurs from the crowd at the base of the mound.
Away with him!
The High Priest shouted, and Hungry Swift and his troopers stood by helplessly, while an angry crowd flowed up the mound and pushed and rolled the helpless pale body down the slope. Sharp prickers were pulled from weapons pouches. They prodded at Pink Eye's edges, forcing him out the eastern orifice of the temple. A storage bin at a nearby needle trooper compound was raided, and 2 dozen long dragon-tooth spears were brought and laid out on the ground. Pink Eyes was then forced onto the row of spear shafts. The ends of the shafts were raised by burly warriors. As Pink Eyes felt his tread leave the crust, he went into hysterical panic. The small, pale body was easily carried to a nearby field. The crust in the field had recently been plowed and seeded, but it would be a long time before the petal plants would grow. Now, however, a more vicious crop was springing up, as warrior after warrior planted a slicer or pricker in the crumbled crust, point upwards. Pink Eye's tread trembled in pain as his body was lowered down over the points. He tried to support his body on the narrow shafts of the spears, while lifting the rest of his tread away from the tormenting pricks. Then, the spear shafts were pulled out from underneath his trembling tread. His tortured body fell helplessly onto the crust, the slicers and prickers glinting up through his topside, wet points glowing white with his juices. In agony, Pink Eyes attempted to lift his pale body off the agonizing shards of dragon crystal, but with each heave, he only sliced his body further. He gave up trying, and slowly spread out as his juices flowed onto the crust.
"Oh, Bright!" his tortured tread cried in muffled agony. "Bring down your blessing, even on these. For they want you too much."
It was half a turn before the butchering crew was called. There was not much meat on that tiny carcass, and the meat had the same sickly paleness that the skin had. One of the butcher crews sucked at a hunk of meat.
"It does not even taste right," she said. "I wouldn't eat this stuff."
"You are right,"
another said, after taking a small taste. So, by common consent, the body was left in the field to dry on the glowing crust, the shrinking skin pricked through with sharp shards of dragon crystal, abandoned by their former owners.
Time, 6:49 and 32 seconds GMT, Monday, 20 June, 2050. Seiko Kaufman Takahashi looked up as her shift relief drifted in from his breakfast, early as usual. Abdul, still sipping a squeezer full of sweet mint tea, pulled himself to the vacant communications console. With a few practiced flips of his left hand, he soon had a copy of Seiko's screen on his console.
"Anything exciting?" he said, as his unbuckled body floated slowly up out of the console seat. He was surprised at the reply, for nothing ever excited Seiko.
"Yes,"
she replied firmly, reaching out to finger a panel. A picture from the Star Image Telescope flashed on both their screens. She did not say another word. She did not have to.
Time, 6:50 and 12 seconds GMT, Monday, 20 June, 2050. Pierre Carnot-Niven, having finished his 10-hour shift and a leisurely dinner, was relaxing.
He sat buckled into a seat in front of a console down in the library, his finger flicking over the screen.
Fatter. More. Fine.
His finger traced another line.
Now the other arm. Same as the first. Good.
He stretched back and surveyed his handiwork on the screen with pride. The image of the child on the screen now looked the way it should, although the baby fat pudginess made it an unlikely candidate for what he would make it do next. However, that image was just what he had been striving for. The audience for his scan book needed to identify, even if they couldn't copy. He leaned over to the screen and touched the right hand of the image. Put a ball in this hand. A ball was instantly there, with the fingers of the hand open to grasp it.
Now comes the difficult part, he thought. We'll see how good the body action subroutine is.
He spoke again.
Throw the ball from here, along here, to here. Use Earth gravity.
While he spoke, his finger scribed a curve leading from the hand along a high arc down into the background area of the picture. He watched as the body in the image leaned back in a slightly jerky movement and launched the ball into the air. The ball rose and then fell back to the ground, stopping abruptly without a bounce. The computer handled the perspective very nicely. The ball grew smaller and smaller as it sailed into the distance.
Good. Repeat with lunar gravity.
The scene was repeated with the words lunar gravity in the upper corner of the screen. The ball now rose much more slowly, with a significantly flatter trajectory. Pierre spoke again.
Repeat both.
The two scenes repeated their actions. First, Earth gravity, then lunar gravity. Pierre watched, checking them carefully. They would look much better after they were fleshed out with the publisher's curved surface software routine. He then generated another one using Mars gravity. There weren't many of his readers on Mars yet, but he suspected there would be by the time he returned to Earth. Pierre leaned toward the screen.
Earth gravity picture. Rotate 45 degrees to right. Display action.
He watched as the action repeated, this time a scene from the side. The ball rose in a nice parabolic trajectory. He smiled and thought,
the kids have had their fun imagining that their bodies are strong enough to throw a ball 50 meters. Now they will have to get to work and learn some science, which, after all, is why they are scanning the book.
He spoke aloud. Shrink ball by 2. Shrink child by 5. Put in graph axes. Vertical, here. His hand reached out and scribed a line from the top of the screen down to the miniature figure, now tossing a baseball as big as its head. Pierre was halfway through getting the coordinate axes numbered and the parabolic equation placed in the picture where it would be out of the way of the trajectory, when he was interrupted by a message that flashed on the upper part of the screen.
Link from Bridge Console.
Pierre looked up.
Accept link, he said.
Hi, Pierre. Could you come up to the main deck? There is something happening on Dragon's Egg. We want you to confirm our suspicions. Caesar.
Sure, Doc, Pierre said. Be right there. Break link. Store under trajectory graph. Detach job.
He unbuckled from the console chair and pushed himself quickly up the passageway leading to the main deck as the computer obediently flashed confirmation after confirmation toward his disappearing feet.
Link broken. Save trajectory graph. Earth gravity. Detach job 3. Pierre. Account, Golden Science Press. Time,
6:52:30, 20 June 2050. Used 1:26 in 1:36:33. Pierre swung onto the bridge and over to the group looking at some fresh printouts. As he floated over, he could see that they were pictures from the high-resolution star image telescope. Caesar spoke up as he approached.
"Sorry to drag you up on your break, Pierre, but these printouts are really bewildering. Since you are our resident expert on neutron star crustal activity, we figured you could make a better evaluation than we could."
Seiko handed him a sheet.
"I took these off the star image telescope this shift. This one was taken at 0645 hours. Notice the pattern here near the west limb."
Pierre looked briefly at the printout. The chaotic hash of the west limb region was almost familiar by now. But there was something new there, a short, arc-like pattern. Seiko was right. As of yesterday, there had been no such structure at that place on Dragon's Egg. "It looks like wrinkle ridges that you could get on any crusted object with a liquid core. In fact, there are many similarities between those patterns and the ones near the caloric pole of Mercury. But wait, the directions in the pattern are all wrong. From what I know about the behavior of neutron star crustal material under the influence of high magnetic fields, the ridges should all be aligned along the magnetic field lines."
"So far, we have all come to the same conclusion," Seiko said. "This pattern is not a wrinkle ridge from a collapse of the surface. Besides, we have been monitoring the spin speed of the star, and if there had been a slump of that magnitude in the past day, it would have shown up as a glitch in the rotation period, and there has been none."
"Now," Abdul said, "show him the kicker." Seiko pulled out another sheet from beneath the first.
"This was taken at 0648 hours, just before Dr. Wong finished a laser scan of that region."
She passed it over without further comment. Pierre saw an elongated oval shape, with 10 oval dots around it and one in the middle. The dots on the outside were connected to the large oval with short, exponentially tapered horns. There were slight traces of 2 more dots that would complete the symmetric pattern. "The direction of the oval looks generally east-west," he said.
"It is," Seiko stated,
with the calm assurance of someone who had taken the trouble to check.
"The semi-major axis is within less than a milliradian of magnetic east, so the pattern is dominated by magnetic effects and not rotational effects. But the lines that make up the oval are not straight magnetic east-west, as are all the other cliffs and wrinkle ridges in that area."
"It looks like something that is stretched," Pierre said, holding the printout up to his eye. "In fact, from this angle, it looks exactly like a sheriff's star in an old Western movie, complete with a bullet hole in the center. However, it isn't complete. There are only 10 points." He looked up, and the others watched his expression change from initial surprise to suspicion. "You're kidding me," he said.
"No," Caesar said. "We are deadly serious. I knew you would have a tough time accepting this without better proof, so I had Seiko fix up the star image telescope with the filters for direct viewing."
Pierre knew from the tone that Caesar was serious and that the image print was real, but he still found himself diving up the passageway toward the star image telescope control post. He floated in, quickly checked the filter settings, then flicked the switch that opened the direct viewport. The light beamed in from overhead and down onto the white frosted tabletop in the center of the room. He drifted over and hung above the glaring image and adjusted the strobe controls until the spinning image in the center of the table slowed down and finally stopped rotating. He found the symmetric, flower-like diagram. Pierre looked up as the others came up the passageway. "The diagram is now complete," he said. They gathered around the table and looked down at the image, as Pierre whispered softly.
"It is not only complete. There are no extra lines. There can be no other logical explanation. Whatever that is, it was made by intelligent beings."
"Intelligent beings?" Seiko exclaimed. "That is impossible. The surface gravity of that star is 67 billion Gs, and the temperature is 8,200 degrees. Any being that existed on that star would be a flat, growing pancake of solid neutrons."
"They wouldn't be made of neutrons," Pierre replied. "My measurements show that although the interior of the star is made of neutrons, the outer crust has a density more like that of a white dwarf star, and its composition is quite complex, with most of the same atomic nuclei that we have in the Earth's crust, only much more neutron-rich, and without the electron clouds around them." Pierre was perplexed. They had a mission here at Dragon's Egg. The mission was to get as much scientific data as possible from their vantage point, only 400 kilometers from the neutron star. His problem was that the magic gravitational elevator that had put them down into this orbit only a few days ago would soon finish its complicated interlaced orbital pattern and would be returning to take them away again. They had only a limited amount of time.
What should they do?
Abdul spoke. "I don't really come onto shift for over an hour. Why don't I try to generate some kind of signal to send down, in case there really is some form of intelligent life there, while the rest of you keep up with the science timeline?"
"Fine," Pierre said. "We have finished with a laser radar mapper on this hemisphere, so you can use that. If you need anything else, let me know. I am sure we can reschedule an experiment for later on in the program."
Abdul pushed his way to the communications console. Soon, a simple 123 dot dash number series was beaming down to the surface, followed by a crude diagram of Dragon Slayer inside the six tidal compensator masses over the sphere that was Dragon's Egg. It was a dot dash pattern, 53 by 71 dots on a side. Trek. Time, 7:54:43, GMT, Monday, 20 June, 2050. Commander Swiftkiller fixed her attention out toward the horizon. Each of her 8 watch eyes reported back that the shallow arc of a needle-like dragon tooth could still be seen, held at guard position by one of the perimeter guards. She left the watch eyes at their automatic duty and scanned her other eyes around the camp where the rest of her troopers were relaxing. Most were still eating, but a few had paired off and were now enjoying each other over in one corner of the camp. She looked at them enviously and was tempted to pass over the watch to her second-in-command, go get her favorite fun partner and join them. But the last contact with the barbarians had only been a turn ago, and they must stay at full alert. Frustrated in her bodily pleasures, Swiftkiller turned to her other personal form of recreation, trying to figure out why things work. She paused, concentrated for a moment, and her body pushed out some pseudopods. She then grew some articulated crystallium bones under the protrusions of tough, muscular skin to form manipulators. The bones in the manipulators were small, not like the ones that she grew to hold her shield and sword in battle. Still keeping her watch eyes on the horizon, Swiftkiller glanced with the remaining eyes at the 4 extremities, made a minor change to one of them, then reached through the sphincter of a carrying pouch in her body and pulled out her experiments. One experiment was an old one that she had come upon in the last campaign. Their pursuit of the barbarians had taken them into strange territory, where the crust was not smooth, but had suffered a recent shaking. In that region, the crust did not have its usual fibrous plasticity, but was almost as hard as dragon crystal. The quake had shattered the crust into many flat plates, their cleaved surfaces glinting with the reflected image of the god Bright that hung motionless over the South Pole. Her mind always active, Swiftkiller had collected several plates and had played with them, turning them first one way, then the other, to bring the image of Bright to each of her eyes in turn. She had even held one well up above normal eye level. It had taken most of her bone-forming crystallium to support the plate against Egg's tremendous gravity pull, and had actually looked at her own topside. It looked weird to her, what with the deep red color, the reddish-yellow lump of her brain nodule near the middle, and the smaller lump of a forming egg next to it. She had hastily withdrawn the plate, and had glanced around quickly to reassure herself that no one had seen her examining her own topside. Unless it was your lover trying to get you in the mood, no one ever talked about one's topside, much less looked at it. As a troop commander, she had found an excellent use for the mirror plates. A glancer was now standard battle equipment on the Eastern Front. With careful aim of the mirror to reflect the image of Bright in the right direction, messages and commands could be sent over great distances to other squads without alerting the barbarians. They still used the old code patterns for the commands, since the limitations of the Glancer communication system were similar to the old technique that used synchronized thumps of the treads of a trooper squad on the crust. With this new communication technique, the element of surprise that they had gained over the barbarians had decreased their losses by significant factors. Swiftkiller placed her collection of equipment on the crust. Along with the glancers, there was another of her discoveries, the flares. The fact that certain types of crust would glow when pod juice dropped on them had been known since ancient history. Swiftkiller had been intrigued by this effect, and everywhere she went in her service to the leader of the combined clans, she had always sacrificed a few drops of her daily ration of pods to the crust to see how brightly it would glow. She had recently come across a very reactive portion of crust. A drop of pod juice would make a blue-white flare of light, almost too bright to look at. She had carefully used a slicer to extract some long, fibrous rods out of the crust. These were her flares. She had visited a chemist at the base hospital, and soon her enthusiasm persuaded him to use his ancient arts to separate the various components of a large batch of pod juice until she had a small vial of cast dragon crystal with the concentrated essence of the factor in the pod juice that made the flares glow. Swiftkiller tested out the flare by holding the vial above the end of the stick and letting a few drops of fluid fall on the end. The eyes on that side of her body popped reflexively into their skin pouches as the brilliant blue-white glare of light burst forth. Swiftkiller noticed with pleasure the murmur of startled treads vibrating through the crust to her.
"The commander is at it again. Now what is she up to?"
Remembering her prime duty, she turned her attention to her watch eyes and again assured herself that each one still had a distant dragon tooth firmly fixed in its vision. She noticed that one or two of them also had a fuzzy spot off to one side, where they had picked up the momentary glare of the flashing flare. However, true to their assigned duties, they had not ducked into their skin pouch of the bright glare. With the flare ready, she then turned her attention to her latest discovery, the expander. She had come upon it not long ago when she had been out visiting the perimeter guards. Normally, that task was the duty of one of the squad leaders, but since her favorite at that time had been one of the guards, she took the opportunity of an inspection tour to get a few moments alone with him. Of course, being on guard, he had to remain at alert with his eyes on the horizon, while giving stiffly formal responses to her queries. Although her questions followed the usual routine of an inspection of the guard, her actions took advantage of the fact that he was not allowed to break his at-alert condition. "Who approaches?" boomed the crust as his tread rippled at her approach.
"Troop Commander Swiftkiller," she replied.
"You may approach," he said. So she did, and got closer and closer and closer until her body was pressed up right next to his and it flowed around in a crescent that nearly enveloped his periphery. Her cool, dark red eyes stared right into his, while he dutifully kept his gaze fixed on the horizon.
"Report," she commanded.
But instead of using solid talk, she whispered it with an electronic tingle that sent thrills through his frustrated body. "Guard to the east under observation and secure. Guard to the west under observation and secure. No unknown objects on the horizon. All secure, Commander Swiftkiller," boomed his muffled report in formal solid talk. She then felt a soft electronic whisper as he added,
"But I seem to be under attack from Brightside." "At alert," she barked, and felt his body stiffen.
"What is this I see?"
she said, as her eyes went up on Stubbs to look at his topside.
"Dirt,"
she said severely, and reaching out a soft, muscular pseudopod, she proceeded to brush imaginary specks of dirt off his topside, making sure that she had touched all of his sensitive spots in the process.
"Just for that, Squad Leader Northwind. After you have been relieved of your post, you shall report to me for extra duty,"
she said, with a mixture of solid talk and electronic whisper that trailed off into a pure whisper at the words,
"extra duty,"
that left no doubt in his mind what that duty would consist of. Commander Swiftkiller slowly slid her body along Northwind, who kept his outer perimeter in the prescribed circle, and his eyes on the horizon. Then, drawing herself back into proper traveling form, she went off to visit the next guard on the perimeter, leaving an emotionally frustrated Northwind at his post, his eyes and body at attention, but his mind full of things other than non-existent barbarians.
"He does not have too much longer before the change of the guard," she thought as she moved off to inspect the next guard. "But by that time, will he be ready?"
The next guard had always been one of her problem troopers. She had never really learned discipline. Although Easy Mover had never given any trouble when under direct supervision, she did not have the proper spirit of a real needle trooper and would not discipline herself to act always in the manner of a trooper, even when there was no superior officer nearby. Unfortunately, the lonely duty of perimeter guard gave her plenty of opportunity to become lax, and she had been caught so many times that she had never been able to keep any of her promotions for very long.
"She is at it again," Swiftkiller said to herself as she approached the guard and felt a telltale grinding noise in the crust beneath her tread.
Her eyes carefully surveyed the guard, but there was not one sign of motion in the body of the guard, or the arc of Dragon Tooth that jutted out towards the horizon. A challenge replaced the grinding noise as the guard noticed her approach.
"Who approaches?"
boomed the guard.
"Troop Commander Swiftkiller," she replied.
"You may approach,"
came the formal reply. Swift Killer flowed to one side of the rigid trooper and barked,
"Move here in front of me."
There was a moment's hesitation, bad enough in itself, and then the trooper swiftly flowed over and resumed the formal guard position. Swift Killer went to the spot that the guard had vacated, formed a manipulator, and picked up the two plates of broken crust that lay there. The plates were placed one on top of the other. As Swift Killer took them apart, a dusty powder of ground-up crust fell to the surface. Bored with guard duty, Easy Mover had been holding her outside surface at alert, but had been absent-mindedly rubbing one plate against another under her tread. This was not the first time she had been caught doing something like that, so it didn't surprise Swift Killer.
"You are already down to trooper, so I can't demote you any further," Swift Killer barked at the now rigid form of Easy Mover. "But until you learn that troopers on guard duty are to remain at full alert at all times, you will have to make do without recreation periods. Since this is not your first offense, it will be a dozen turns this time."
Swift Killer thought she detected a quiver of protest. But fortunately for Easy Mover, she recovered rapidly with her reply.
"Yes, Commander," she said.
Swift Killer then took the guard through the remainder of her formal report and left to inspect the rest of the perimeter, taking the two plates with her to remove temptation from the scene.
A dozen turns with no recreation is not only going to be hard on her, but also on about three males that I know of, Swift Killer thought as she flowed off. I don't know how she keeps them all happy. One lover at a time is enough for me.
The offending plates had been tucked away in one of Swift Killer's carrying pouches, and she had forgotten about them until their shape got in the way during her fun and games with the eager north wind. She had put them to one side and had attended to more important business, such as thinning herself down and slithering under the hot, kneading tread of North Wind as their eye stubs entwined softly about one another. They took turns kneading each other's topside with their treads, concentrating on their favorite spots. Then, with their eye stubs firmly intertwined to pull their very edges together, their mutual vibrations raised in pitch with an electronic tingle adding an overtone of spice to the massage. Finally, in a multiple spasm of their bodies, a dozen tiny perimeter orifices just under North Wind's eye stubs opened to emit a small portion of his inner juices into the waiting folds around Swift Killer's eye stubs. Swift Killer felt the tiny globules of North Wind as they were carried by her automatic reflexes to the egg case. She slowly gathered herself into her more normal shape and slid from beneath the still thinned and exhausted North Wind. She left him lying there and began to pick up the various things she had laid aside from her carrying pouches. As each item was tucked away, she became less and less Swift Killer the lover. Finally, as she placed the four-button symbol of her rank into a holding sphincter on her side, she turned back into Troop Commander Swift Killer. As she came to the last few items, she picked up the crustled plates that she had taken from Easy Mover. The plates no longer had flat surfaces. Instead, one was slightly hollow, and the other was slightly rounded. Some of the shiny aspect of a freshly cleaved surface was gone, but it was still possible to see a reflection in them. Always inquisitive, Swift Killer looked at the two curved plates and was amazed to see that in one of them her eye looked smaller than normal, while in the other it was larger. She reached out a soft pseudopod and wiped the dust off the surfaces. This improved the image some. Now, completely absorbed in trying to understand the strange behavior of the curved plates,
Swift Killer, the inventor, forgot her lover and her command duties, while her mind wandered off into thought. For many turns, Swift Killer spent her spare time with the curved plates. She talked to Easy Mover and found that she had been carrying those plates for many turns and had used them to relieve her boredom on many tours of perimeter guard duty. Swift Killer duplicated her grinding process and soon had several expander and shrinker mirrors. She found that if she did not apply much pressure in the later parts of the rubbing, the mirrors could be made very shiny, almost as good as the cleaved surfaces of the original plates. She spent a long time on one set of plates to see how curved she could make them, for she had found that the more the mirrors were curved, the more they would expand or shrink the image. Finally, she obtained one pair where something amazing happened. Not only was the image of her eye expanded, it was also turned upside down. She found that if she put her eye very close to the mirror, it would appear right side up and expanded. But as she moved back, it would get bigger and bigger, finally filling the whole mirror with a distorted image, then would finally appear again, upside down. Swift Killer now held one of those expander mirrors. She knew that a flat mirror would reflect the light from her flare, and she wanted to see what the expander would do. Perhaps it would expand the light and make it brighter. Swift Killer formed her body around in a crescent, with her four free eyes moved around so that they were concentrated on the inner part of the crescent where they could observe the experiment. Aware that the light would be quite bright, she had them tucked under their protective folds of skin and had closed the fold until each was only watching through a narrow slit. Carefully, she held the vial of pod juice extract above the flare and adjusted the little crystal valve until a thin stream of liquid fell down on the end of the flare. Soon, she had a continuous bright arc going. Light flared over her body and up into the sky. Using her manipulators, she brought the expander mirror up near the arc. Instead of reflecting the light off in all directions like a flat mirror, it seemed to collect it and make it smaller. She moved the mirror back and forth. She first found a point where the light seemed to go off in a straight beam from the expander. She then found that there was a position in which the light was focused into a spot on the crust. She reached out with a pseudopod to touch the bright spot.
Ow!
The whole camp came to alert as they heard the agonized trum of their troop commander on the crust. Swift Killer, her burned spot sucked into the interior of her body, where it was quickly enveloped in soothing liquid, stopped the flow of pod juice from the vial, waited until the flare stopped glowing, and then put her experiments back into her carrying pouches as her eyes glared around the camp. In short order, all the troopers were very busy. After many turns of experimentation, Swift Killer understood how the expander worked. Halfway between the mirror and the point where her eye flipped from right side up to upside down was the point where the flare would give off a straight beam. If it were in front or in back of that point, the light would be focused to a point, later to spread out again. For a while, Swift Killer thought that she had a new weapon, a thing that would burn at a distance. But a little experimentation showed her that it was far easier and faster to poke a hole in a barbarian with a dragon tooth than to burn one with an expander, assuming that the barbarian would hold still long enough. However, the more she thought about the long-reaching beam of light that she could make, and the old stories about the narrow beams of invisible light that the ancient prophet Pink Eyes had seen, the more she thought that she ought to talk to some of the scientists back in Bright's Heaven
who were trying to make sense of the still pulsating beams. It took some discussion with the commander of the Eastern Front, but after seeing her experiment, he decided to relieve her temporarily of her command and let her make a journey back to Bright's Heaven.
Time, 7:54 and 50 seconds GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050.
The road to Bright's Heaven was long, but fast. It stretched out in a straight line along the easy direction from the Eastern Outpost trooper camp. The way had been smoothed by generations of treads and baggage sleds. Swiftkiller moved along the road at her rapid trooper's glide, her four-button troop commander's insignia automatically clearing the path ahead of her and giving her preferential treatment at the food stations along the way. One of the food station keepers was well known for his interesting and nearly inexhaustible repertoire of love needings, and she had enjoyed a couple of dalliances in previous trips. But her mind was elsewhere when she passed through this time, so she didn't wait for him to return from one of his periodic trips to restock his pod bins. She just took the pods that she needed and continued on her way, crushing the pod with the powerful muscles in her food intake pouch and sucking the tingly juices in through the thin skin at one end of the pouch. Swiftkiller finally arrived at Bright's Heaven, and after a short formal meeting with the commander of the Central Defense Command, she took off to visit the Inner Eye Institute, part of the large Holy Temple complex.
"Troop Commander Swiftkiller," the Institute astrologer greeted her. "We are honored by your visit. The fact that you are here gives us reassurance that the eastern border is safe."
Swiftkiller's eye stubs twisted with embarrassment as the Institute astrologer continued.
"That invention of the glancer has given you a reputation among the astrologers here at the Institute. Have you ever thought about leaving the troopers and becoming one of us?"
Swiftkiller knew what she was best at. Her extraordinary size, strong muscles, and quick intelligence had led her to her natural position as a front-line troop commander. They had also given her a new name, when, as a youngster just barely out of the hatchling pens, she had killed a swift unaided, with only a slicer for a weapon. She enjoyed her hobby of trying to figure out how things worked, but she had no intention of making it her life's work, not as long as there were barbarians trying to destroy Bright's Heaven. She brushed off the Institute astrologer's question with one of her own.
"What is the latest news on the strange pulsating beams from Bright's inner eye?" Swiftkiller asked.
The Institute astrologer hesitated. He and the others in the Inner Eye Institute had been undergoing a difficult conversion. Fortunately, it had happened so slowly that they had had time to overcome the shock. However, they were not sure yet, so neither the populace nor the rest of the temple priests had been informed of their suspicions. The eyes of the Institute astrologer swayed back and forth rhythmically as he evaluated Swiftkiller. He equivocated.
"The beams from Bright's inner eye continue to bring down a message from the mind of Bright," he replied. "The beams are invisible except to certain ones who have what is known as Bright's blessing, although Bright's affliction would probably be a better term for it, as the unfortunate individuals rarely live to breeding age. Fortunately, the alchemists have found a liquid that is sensitive to the invisible beams and turns color temporarily if a vial of it is exposed to the beam. So now we do not have to search the Empire for those unfortunate ones and drag them away from their clans to interpret Bright's message to us."
"The pulsations continue?" Swiftkiller asked.
"Yes," the Institute astrologer replied. "And there seems to be some pattern to them. We are still trying to analyze what they mean. They come so slowly, one pulse every few turns."
The fact that the pulsation seemed to have a pattern intrigued Swiftkiller's inquisitive mind.
May I see what you have collected?
She asked eagerly. The Institute astrologer formed a manipulator, extracted a tally string from a storage pouch, and gave it to Swiftkiller, who quickly ran a tendril down its length.
It is a string of numbers, she exclaimed. Only it stops at 10 and then repeats twice more.
She continued her examination of the tally string.
This seems to be a number system that only goes to 10, then goes into two symbols to represent things larger than 10, she said.
Yes, he replied. And if you go on, you will find that after counting to 10 times 10, new symbols appear, interspersed with the number symbols.
Swiftkiller moved quickly over the repetitious section and found the new symbols. First a 1, then a strange symbol, then another 1, then a different strange symbol, then a 2. The Institute astrologer kept his tread still, while his eye stubs watched the tense body of Swiftkiller. Finally, her eye stubs resumed their normal wave-like motion, and she started murmuring.
1 + 1 = 2. 1 + 2 = 3. 2 + 2 = 4, she said.
Then she turned her attention to the Institute astrologer, and her eyes stared at him, twitching nervously. The Institute astrologer clenched his tread muscles and waited for Swiftkiller's brain to realize what he and the others in the Institute had finally had to face.
This is nothing but a primer in arithmetic, but in a number system that only goes to 10. Surely Bright would not waste time to send such a trivial message and take so long to do it. This is more like an interpreter trying to learn one of the barbarian tongues.
Swiftkiller hesitated, for what she was about to say next went against all her early religious training.
It is almost as if there were a strange clan of barbarians living on the Inner Eye and trying to set up communication with us, she said. But that cannot be.
The Institute astrologer kept his tread quiet and passed over another tally string. This one was a fringe string, with many strings knotted to a main string, and with each side string containing many knots. At first, Swiftkiller could make no sense of it, for there were no symbol groups, only large and small knots. She felt through the fringes, puzzled by the large blank sections.
It took us a long time to figure that one out, the Institute astrologer admitted. In fact, it was a novice who literally stumbled onto it when he happened to glide across the tally fringe as it lay on the crust. Here, let me arrange it.
The Institute astrologer took the tally fringe and laid it out as a rectangle on the crust.
Now glide onto it carefully and see what your tread tells you, he said.
Following his instructions, Swiftkiller moved her body onto the large rectangle, and suddenly it all became clear. Whereas her eyes could only see the tally string at such a low angle that everything was distorted beyond recognition, her touch-sensitive bottom tread could absorb the picture all at once.
It is like a map, said Swiftkiller,
who utilized devices when planning large-scale campaigns.
But it is not any place that I know.